Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minig. I'm the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest. Her name is Antonia Banowitz. Antonia has over 20 years of training and corporate teaching experience. She has her master's degree in interpersonal communication and has taught at NYU and Columbia University. She has also experience in the corporate world for many years as the director of learning and most notably as a chief people officer. She has tons of life experience with therapy, 12-step programs. She even has two certifications, the Mindset Coach certification and the Science of Happiness certification from UC Berkeley. She also is a happiness coach and the owner of Brighter, Better Days. She helps people who are feeling low or depressed and want the desire to have better days. She works with the Science of Happiness principles. Antonia even has a special quote she likes to live by. It is, remember, being happy doesn't mean you have it all. It simply means you're thankful for all you have. Remember, happiness isn't something you go after and then once you get it, you have for good. No. It's an ongoing process of daily maintenance using the tools that the Science of Happiness has uncovered. There again are many things we can do as intentional happiness hygiene habits. We can again practice acts of kindness, learn to forgive and connect with others, and take care of our bodies. Now, again, this could be through physical activity or meditation, as well as practicing gratitude. I'm very excited to have her on the show. We are all in for a special treat. Well, again, Antonia, thank you so much for being on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm looking so forward to talking with you.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a fun journey. It really is.
Yeah. A wild journey, but a fun one.
Yeah. Wild, but good.
Yeah, that's right.
So are you in the East Coast right now?
I am actually in Mexico right now.
Oh, you're in Mexico. Okay.
Yes. I lived on the East Coast for, between New York City and New Jersey about 40 years. And we just moved to Mexico, San Miguel de Allende, and we love it.
So then were you born also on the East Coast too?
No, I was actually born in Dallas, Texas.
Okay.
So yeah, I moved up north to New York City, my favorite city, to be an actor back when I was in my, right out of college, I moved up there. So yeah.
So like, was that more like the Broadway type stuff?
Yeah, I was classically trained. And at first I thought, I only wanted to do theater. But then I realized that was being stupid. There was a whole world of different opportunities, commercials and movies and things like that. So I had some success in commercials and small roles on soaps and things of that nature. And I was in theater groups and we did off Broadway shows. So I was acting the whole time. Mm-hmm. But I ended up changing that path. And I decided that I enjoyed it, but I had tried it and I wanted something more tangible where I could still use my skills, but in a different way. So I went back and got my master's in speech and interpersonal communication. And it was really a training and development degree, learning and performance. It taught you how to train people and teach people in organizations. Mm-hmm. And you learned all about communication. And after that time, I taught at NYU in Columbia briefly. Wow. Yeah. That was a great experience. I loved it. I taught communication and public speaking. So, yeah. And so I so enjoyed doing that and getting my master's. And but my real goal at the time was to get into the corporate world. Okay. And so that's what I ended up doing. And I got my first job was as a director and it was really, beyond my league, but I spent all my time focused on it. And then I worked at Sprint as a director for many years. And then I became a chief people officer at a company called Sterling Info Systems. I was over everything HR and, training, development, and office services. So you're probably wondering how I got into coaching doing this path. And it really started in the corporate world, because I would be coaching employees and executives and corporate issues and problems. And I was also over HR. So I would be coaching and personal problems too. And so that's where I really enjoyed coaching and first started doing it. So it was a long time ago, and I didn't start my own business at all. I didn't even think of it. I just loved working with people and, trying to help them improve their situation, their lives, or whatever. So that's what, really got me going.
So would it be more like in the corporate world, like workplace stress management, conflict resolution between coworkers, maybe?
Oh, absolutely. Lots of conflict resolution.
My aunt's in HR. She actually got her law degree, but never used it. She went to HR. And she told me some doozies of stories of people in the workplace. And I'm sure you have your own stories about, again, like conflict management and interactions.
Yeah, I mean, people would get furious, and there was a lot of, talking people down and helping them to see things differently. So, it was crazy. And the company I was at started to downsize, and that got really bad. Yeah, that was, and I had to do the downsizing. So that was, it was.
Wait a second. They made you fire the people, or you don't? You doing the downsizing?
What I had to do is get up there in front of a group of people and give a speech as to why the company was downsizing and how they would no longer, their services would no longer be needed. And, I was always there as the chief people officer. So I was there to make people happy, to make sure everybody was all right. And I thought, what am I doing? This just isn't the fit for me. It was tough. It was really tough time. And I ended up leaving around that time to go off and do something completely different. And, so that's where I left the corporate world. I could have gone on and tried to get another corporate position. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were things out there, but I kind of had it with the politics at that point. So, I decided to do something different. And I explored a whole new area for a while.
So like life coaching, right? Or what you call happiness coaching is your brand name?
Right. Yep. So I was certified as a mindset coach and I do life coaching as well. But I'm really, my specialty is happiness coaching. That's what I really love to do. And that's where I focus my work. And it's kind of ironic because I'm a happiness coach. And yet what my ideal clientele are people who are feeling sad or low or blue or depressed. And, those are the folks that I tend to attract and work with the most, helping them. I call my company Brighter, Better Days. And it's just because I remember, I've had a long story with depression myself. And I remember having days that were just so gray and I just wanted them to be brighter, So that's where I come from. And my background, I do it because it's a passion of love for me. I did executive coaching before I did this happiness coaching. And I knew it because I had been in the corporate world for a long time, but it was beginning to bore me because I'd been there, done that.
Curious, something that we learned like in group counseling class are, and I'm sure you've heard of this, like the different group member traits, like the empath or the driver or the, do you ever explain that to coworkers and like, hey, if you work with a driver, maybe this is a better approach to take and so forth.
Yes, exactly. Definitely. I've worked with several tools that work with that, the DISC personality profile. I haven't worked with Myers-Briggs, although I've done it. Okay. And very often we would look at, you're, like you said, you're dealing with a director or a driver. And, you know, they don't want to not know an answer. They want to, you know, they want to have solutions only, you know, things like that. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes when I deal with like conflicts at my work or whatever, I'll take a step back and I'm just like, wow, we got a lot of drivers who work here.
Yeah.
Not say drivers can't work together, but they need to understand that. And I think you just, again, have a lot of people who want to be the leader type mentality.
It's true. And, you know, there's a fit for everybody. There really is. You need the people that are the compassionate ones who want to get along, that want to promote good feeling and goodwill. You need the people that are the analyzers, the analytical people, the ones that want to know the numbers, the facts behind it, and why, you know.
Can I ask you something, though? Have you ever actually had going back a little bit farther now, back to the corporate workplace environment, have you ever had to work with a group with, again, just my example, a lot of drivers?
Yes.
And then you have to tell me, hey, most of you guys are drivers. This is your mentality. How can we make this work type thing?
Oh, yeah, very much so. As a matter of fact, I've worked with bosses that have been real drivers, and they've had issues with other managers at leadership level. Plus, they've had issues with their own employees. And I've had to say exactly that, you know, you're coming from, you know, you want things done immediately and solutions and answers, and you want to direct things, but you're working with someone who's more of an ideas person, who's more of a, let me process this and come up with, you know, what if we try it and let's think about, and, you know, not so much answers all the time.
Have you ever dealt with a situation too, where let's say you have the boss driver, and you have the employee that's under the driver, and the boss is like, well, I don't care. I'm the boss driver, so he's going to do what I say.
Oh, amazingly, a lot in the corporate world, you know. It's interesting. I got to tell you, now we're speaking about emotional intelligence a lot. And I found a lot of folks at high levels were not particularly emotionally intelligent, and they didn't have much of an understanding of, you know, and early in my career, I was learning it too. So I became much more skilled at it as I grew further in my career to be able to say, you know, and I'd have them take emotional intelligence quizzes on, you know, online, to actually see where their strengths were and where their weaknesses were, because they wanted to direct everyone to do everything, micromanage, you know, that whole thing. Yeah.
And one can maybe make the argument, or they may say, well, I got this far with my driver mentality.
Yeah. Right. I know. So. And that's a tough one, because, you know, it's true, that is honored. I think it's honored less now in the corporate world. I think people are realizing that leadership styles need to change and be different now, and be more motivational and not as driver oriented. But you're right, they did get that way by making quick decisions. And that's a real talent too. It's just that it doesn't work with a lot of, I mean, you've got, you know, you got drivers are in one quarter, and then you've got three quarters made of other personality types. So, you know, and so it's learning to get along. And again, back to that emotional intelligence.
You know, and another powerful thing, have you ever heard of the motto, the Chahari window?
Oh, yes.
I love it.
I love that model. That's a great one. Yes.
Yep.
What others know about you that you don't
the
know.
Blind.
Yes. Yep. Yes, exactly. So, you know, I'm amazed you brought that up, because I learned that really early on in my master's degree, the Johari window. That is such a cool tool. Yeah,
it is. No. Okay. So going back to your corporate career, when you're transitioning, right?
Yeah.
Now you wanted something different. So it wasn't necessarily that you were kind of burnt out of the corporate world, but it was more of you wanted a different adventure, right?
You know, this is where my entrepreneurial side kicks in. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur, have my own thing.
Yep.
And one thing I love is decorating homes.
Okay.
So I actually changed tunes completely for a while, and I became a home stager. And I had a touch of class home staging in New Jersey. And that was a lot of fun. I was very excited. I loved it. And I did it for a while. But, you know, getting clients in that space is, you know, working. I like real estate, but I don't love it. Mm-hmm. And it's working with agents a lot and getting people of that nature to come on board. And I did it for several years, but I got to the point where I found I missed the coaching part, mm-hmm. not the corporate, you know, agenda, but the coaching part. I really missed that. And mm-hmm. I loved design and, you know, I think I did well at it, but I missed the communication because, you know, being an actor and then teaching and then that's really deeply ingrained in me, I realized. Okay. So that was the first like shift that I made after the acting shift where I kind of went, okay, I need to get back into working with people in some way, shape or form. And so I got certified as a mindset coach. And that's when I went into executive coaching because that's what I knew, you know. So I did that and it took me a while to make that decision. It was a transition, but I did. And that's how I got into the coaching world.
Okay. So you established yourself as a life coach. Now, were you a life coach a little bit in New Jersey or then did you move to, was it Mexico or?
I just moved to Mexico last July. So So it's still a new thing for me. It's like a new city and talk about happiness. I mean, a couple of things. I've done coaching in New Jersey. That was where I did all my coaching. But I've had people from all across the states and particularly now, and that I've moved to Mexico. I don't know what it is, but I'm working with people across the United States now.
That's so cool.
It is cool. It is. Now you have to keep your time zone straight, but it's, it's a lot of fun.
You know, it's funny. I just recently interviewed another life coach and everything. We were talking about how when we start our businesses and even podcasting is a business that are an ownership of, you know, regardless of how big and small it is. And again, I'm not sure what your financial situation was, but was there ever like a fear of jumping into this field and like, oh, what if I don't make enough money to live or pay bills? Did you ever have that kind of worry?
Oh yeah, definitely. Particularly when I started coaching in New Jersey, doing my own thing, I was nervous as hell. You know, I really was because I wanted to make a certain amount of income and we needed to, and I did okay. You know, so that was good, but it was tough. The first, you know, couple of years, that was tough, man, you know, and you have to become just as good at marketing as you are coaching. And
I was actually going to ask you, what would you say right now to a person who wants to start a really cool and awesome life coaching business to be successful like you? Like, what would you give them? Like, what kind of advice would you give them?
Well, one thing that that I didn't do until late in my career, which I'm finding is really helpful, and I wish I'd done it sooner, is to hire a business coach, somebody who really knows their stuff. You know, when you're a coach, and I've been through years of therapy, and I've done coaching with people before, but when you're a coach, and part of what you have to do is market yourself, it really pays to have somebody who knows the arena. You know, my business coach has given me great suggestions and guidance. And so that's one thing I would say is get somebody who really knows what they're doing. They can really, you know, cut the timeline in half for you. And they help to keep you motivated because it's really tough. You know, when you go into your own, as I'm sure you know, go into your own solo business and become a solopreneur. And then the other thing is learning marketing is another thing I tell people in the beginning of their business, because, you know, you are focused on getting your certification as a coach and, you know, doing coaching, and that's where your head is, or at least that's where mine was. And I realized, oh, my head can't be completely there anymore. It's got to be as a business owner. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've got to learn what marketing's about, you know, what are Facebook ads and the Facebook business page and LinkedIn and, you know, and which ones am I going to pursue and, you know, all of that stuff. So, you know, I'd say the education and marketing is really just as important, if not more so, in the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, now,
did your business coach also help you with pricing? Because I'm sure you're like in your head, well, how much is a good amount to charge my clients? Because I don't think a lot of insurances take health coaching as a form of payment, right? So you have to like go under the table type.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my business coach has helped me with that. And the other thing that helped me is I took some, there's some terrific also online courses on marketing out there. And they would have modules just on price. And we'd have, you know, webinars on pricing and what, you know, and it really comes down to finding that sweet spot mm-hmm. where you feel comfortable and you're not going too low, but yeah. you're not going so high that you don't believe it yourself.
Right.
You know, it's got to be right in the sweet spot.
It was funny. I was listening to a therapy podcast about like building private practices. And this one therapist told another therapist about pricing is she's like, make your hourly amount to the point where you start feeling a little uncomfortable about how much you're charging someone and yeah. then stop right there.
That's good. I like that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I would say that's the same thing because it's always a little out of your comfort zone because if you charge too low, then you're just, you know, negotiating on price and, you know, becoming the lowest price vendor and you don't want that either, you know.
But do you ever just get the people in your field that walk up to you and be like, well, it's not all about the money or we don't always do it. It's for the clients. And again, I don't know about you, but that kind of, again, just grinds my gears because it's just like, why can't we help our clients have yeah. great lives, but then also take care of ourselves? Like, why can't we do both?
Well, exactly. Because you're paying for a service, you're yeah. paying for something that, and it is valuable. You know, I've seen that in the beginning, you may not know how valuable it is, but once you do it for a while, you start to go, hey, you know, there's mm-hmm. some real results here. And this does work. It does yeah. produce better lives for people. You know, and that, what, how do you put money on that? You know, that's right. just, you know, priceless. So mm-hmm. I'm a big proponent of coaching and I agree with therapy too. I think anything we can do to discover more about ourselves and to grow and improve, you know, mm-hmm. I think that's what we're here to do is to, you know, keep growing, you know, experiencing, you know.
I'm just curious. So when you're like working with your clients, have you ever dealt with the situation where, let's say the severity of the depression was like very high or the trauma, like, would you ever feel like, hey, you know, I feel like I need to refer this person to a therapist as well as working with me?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I even do a questionnaire as an exploratory call where I ask them, I ask them questions just to find out where they're at in their experience. Mm-hmm. And then I ask them, are they seeing a therapist? Are they on medication? You know, all these things that, because I'm not a therapist and I'm not going to pretend to be. Mm-hmm. And there are people, you know, with happiness coaching and life coaching, you have to be at a certain level where you want to do it. And there are people that are in such a level of depression that they're not ready yet to yeah. take that next step. And they're not going to be ideal clients for me. You know, I had a girl just recently, a woman, I should say, and she's going through a lot of stuff in her own life. And she is, her husband has Parkinson's and she's and she's dealing with seeing him, you know, get less and less of his life. And so that's been very tough and difficult. And she's also, you know, a recovering alcoholic. And so she, you know, is in her first year. So that's, you know, all of that is so much to deal with. Mm-hmm. And she has just bouts of depression that she is having trouble getting out of. And she wants to do happiness coaching, but she's not quite ready yet. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we talk about, you know, okay, we're going to do it, but just, you know, work with your therapist. She's seeing a new therapist, get that going, mm-hmm. you know, get, you know, maybe an adjustment to medication might be necessary. So mm-hmm. that's an example, you know.
Do you ever work with a therapist, like work with the therapist as a coordination of care, or do you just like have her check in with her therapist and you check in with her, or?
I I have worked with therapists before that have referred clients to me. In general, though, I haven't had therapists come to me and say, how's she doing with life coaching? I just haven't had that. Maybe that has happened to, you know, other people. Mm-hmm. In general, you know, I work through the client directly, you know, and if there's something I need to tell the therapist, like if I ever heard anything that was suicidal or even going on that line, of course, I would call immediately, which is why I want to know if they're in therapy and, you know, how the extent of their condition. So,
you know, it's also interesting too. Again, like life coaching or wellness coaching is not really a licensed profession in the United States. Mm-hmm. So it's not uncommon to actually see therapists become life coaches as well.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot happening a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's great. I think therapists would make great coaches. It is a real switch in how you think, though. That's the only thing. It's not the past anymore that you're working on all over the place. It's more present oriented and future oriented, you know.
Well, see, like myself as a therapist and you as a life coach. Now, I don't know if this is very common, but I know, is life coaching more just kind of like giving positive, healthy advice, or is there like helping the client achieve a certain goal? What is that? I guess, what is your curriculum more about?
Okay. So when I work with people just that need, like I have a client now, I'll use her as an example. I've had her for years now, and she continues to coach, and she could be termed as having some low moods at times. She goes through that. But she's not my primary, you know, science of happiness client.
Okay.
So I do coaching with her on goals. We do goal setting. We do some of the science of happiness work because I think anyone can use that and she loves it and benefits from it. We do, planning for the future. We also talk about some of the things that are going on with her family. She's having some problem. Her sister has Alzheimer's and she's having to deal with that. So we talk about, without getting into what happened when she was a little girl and, you know, all of that, that's going into therapy. We do talk about her family situation though, and how to communicate through those issues. And so there's a lot of communication that comes up. I mean, partly, I guess, because my background is in communication, but you know, that comes up a lot too. How do you communicate with family when you're going through difficult times? And
All right. And again, the different styles of communication, like passive aggressive, aggressive, assertive.
Yes. Yes. And there's a lot of, passivity and aggressiveness out there.
Boundary settings.
Boundary settings. Oh yeah, I was just working with a girl. It was last night on setting boundaries with her parents that were highly religious, and you know how she felt so much better when she finally set boundaries, as difficult and uncomfortable as that was at first. You know.
Yep. Yep. And it's funny too, when I talk to my clients about the different types of boundaries, again, it's much more than just like, let's say, touching or verbal. It could be material boundaries, like lending cars, or financial boundaries. Or,
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. There's a whole series of different areas you could get into. You know, do you find that boundary setting is tough for a lot of people?
Yes.
Okay, because I do, yeah.
Even for not just like clients, just the everyday person, I think it is very hard.
I think so, and I think, you know, it's interesting. I was having this discussion with someone, but with Facebook and social media, everything's so out there right now that boundaries are even more blurred, it seems, you know?
Oh, exactly, because what's the word I'm thinking about right now? Well, a lot of it's about just like a compromising too in relationships about certain situations. Like the other day, in one of my interviews, it was about like a husband and wife, and we just painted a hypothetical scenario, right? Like, let's say the in-laws are too involved in how, let's say, you raise your child. Okay. Well, if it's the wife's parents,
Is it up to the wife to set the boundary with her parents? Same with the husband. Like, whose role is it to set the boundaries with certain people?
Oh, that's an excellent question. So did you guys work through that? Is that?
Well, she had a great answer. She told me, because again, she's another life coach. She's like, hopefully you would have a healthy enough relationship where either one of you can go to each other's parents and just in a healthy manner express, hey, yes, you know, we don't appreciate this. We're going to do it this way, you know, and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, going back to that healthy communication, that's mm-hmm. a great answer. Yeah.
And I feel like this sometimes too, when you are assertive and again, set those boundaries, you feel like a weird kind of bad feeling, even though you shouldn't, because you're displaying love for yourself when you set those boundaries in assertiveness. Yes. But you want to take on their emotions too at the same time.
Yeah. So again,
that's again, more boundary issues, because again, you're not responsible for how they feel about you taking care of yourself.
Oh gosh, is that a big one? You are not responsible for how they feel taking care of yourself. That is so, that's so key. That's incredible.
Even when I talk to my clients in group, whatever, and we talk about, even if you, again, this kind of gets into the Jarhari window when you're letting someone know about their blind spot, about how they're behaving and acting, even people are like, are afraid to even do it in a nice way because they're still afraid of what or how that person's going to react. I tell them that's not your responsibility. If you approach it in a respectful manner and you kindly assert yourself, and if they want to react a certain way, that's their problem.
Yeah, that's so true. And that people, I think, universally have trouble with that one. You know, I mean, I know I struggled with it in my life. And the thing is, when we worry about so much about the other person that we don't want to stand up for ourselves, we're actually doing a disservice to the other person. Because they're hopefully at that point an adult too, and they can make their own life decisions as mm-hmm. far as how to handle it and react to it. Maybe they need to have a reaction that's not easy at first. Maybe that's what they go through.
You know, and it's funny, like we had when I was doing a group a couple of days ago, whenever we had a former coworker come in, great lady, a very nice lady. She just retired and everything. And I was doing a group, but like a couple tables over, there's a couple other co-workers talking to her and everything. So, you know, she was visiting, let's say. And I was in the middle of doing group and they were just kind of talking loudly. So it was kind of interfering with our group a little bit. But again, I'm staff, they're staff. And it kind of made me uncomfortable to be like, even in a nice way, to like tell them, hey guys, can you quiet down?
Yeah.
So like I turned and I kind of looked at them, but again, I was almost in a passive manner, just hoping one of them would look in my direction, then I would say, hey, calm down.
Yeah.
And I didn't. But again, one of the coworkers saw me and they were just like, oh, I think Jake wants us to be quiet. So then I turned over again. I'm like, yep, yeah, I want you to be quiet.
Yeah, good.
And again, I was a little disappointed in myself because it's like, it was a passive way of like doing that where I wish I could go back and just been a little bit more assertive and I would have been in the right.
Yeah, that's true. I know what you mean. I mean, the way you did it is okay too, but I know what you mean about you kind of wish you had stood up and said, you know, gone over and said, hey guys, quiet down, which would have been perfectly all right.
It was very nice to see you again.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because again, they were interrupting my group a little bit or there would be a distraction. So I should get again, I'm going to take this as a learning experience, been like, hey, please be quiet. Yeah. So
that is so true. Yeah. I still have trouble with that, you know, and I'm 63 and I've come a lot more into saying what I need to say, what it needs to be said, and less worried about what the other person thinks. But I really came from parents that were like, you know, if they argued, they would just shut down because they wouldn't, you know, discuss it. Now, I had to learn what it was to argue from a boyfriend, you know, when I got older, because I was like told, you know, my parents showed me that you just shut down when you get into an argument and you don't discuss it. And I thought that's what you did, that you expected people to read your mind, you know.
It would be a lot easier, right?
Yeah. So exactly. So I grew up with a very passive sort of communication, you know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Then I sometimes deal with families who again do the shunning where it's like, I'm just not going to talk to you for a couple of days to show you that I'm angry at you.
Yes.
Which is the worst way you can handle any conflict at all.
Yeah. Oh,
very sad.
So it is so sad. It is. I know. And all that time goes by and yep. things are left unsaid. Sometimes they never get said. I mean, mm-hmm. it's communication is just in a relationship is just, you know, it's 80% of it, 90% of it, really.
Oh, yeah. It's the base to any relationship.
Yeah, right.
And right. like you said, that was the main issue, right, in the corporate world with working with a team, whatever. It's just sometimes it's just miscommunication and it starts wars.
It does start wars. It really does. And the other thing that, you know, people don't do very well is they don't listen very well. And I used to do listening training, and it was one of the most needed trainings as far as study showed out there. But did people really want to go to a listening training? No, you know.
Oh my God, tell that to my clients right now. That is the main thing we are working on. It is
really
it's a universal problem, but like when I'm running groups, it's like, okay, hypothetical, like Ben, if he's talking, you need to be quiet. But they'd be so angry at each other, they'd be yelling, swearing back and forth. And it's just like, and again, I don't mind calling each other out, but doing it in a respectful, assertive manner and stop yes. and listen. So when they're done, then you can speak. It's difficult for them to do that.
Yeah. Well, we're so busy planning our next comeback. You know what
You're
I mean?
Not listening to them. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's so true. So,
or I've been guilty of, and I'm sure a lot of people have, is just like you're just in a bad mood or you're tired and cranky and someone's talking to you, but you just don't want to be talking to them. So sometimes I'll just be like, so they would go away and I could walk away.
Yeah, real passive listening. Right, right. I know.
The problem is, though, if they actually ask you like an intelligent question, whatever, you can't go,
You're like, okay.
Okay, shoot, they actually asked me a question.
Would you repeat that, please?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, that's so true. Yeah, well, you know, listening, active listening takes a lot of energy. You know, you have to really pay attention. And I think that a lot of us don't know that or don't have the energy to do that, you know?
Well, do you think like in those trainings, one of the first things they teach you is like mindfulness, active listening, or is there some mindfulness technique involved in that?
You know, back when I started, there wasn't mindfulness techniques involved. However, by the time I was towards the end of the corporate career, we were doing, you know, short meditations in class to get people ready for the learning and for the listening, like you said. Okay. Yeah, and it's really big now is what I understand. I think they're starting to really focus on mindfulness because that's just such a huge portion that's critical to everything, yes. You know? I'm sure in your work, you are always trying to get your clients to be more mindful and to practice a mindfulness.
I do. Yeah. I always like I'm doing like a meditation video to start the day. Or I've done Tai Chi with my clients. I put in the video and we'd be like,
that's excellent. Yeah, great.
So you have your company, The Brighter, Better Days, right? You have a system. It's called the Science Happiness Principles, right?
Yes.
Want to elaborate more on that a little bit?
You know, positive psychology has become real big right now. And we're looking at ways that people can be happier through that. And there's a leg of that called Science of Happiness. And, you know, Time Magazine published a whole magazine on the science of happiness. So I'm sure you know all that. Yep. Yeah, exactly. And Sonia Libamirsky, who's one of the main researchers in the science of happiness, she actually did a study on our happiness levels. And this is kind of where it starts. Some people agree with it, some people don't, but it's pretty much taken as a truth that we have about 50% of our happiness level is determined by our genetic set point.
I agree.
Yeah, so we're born with it. So we can't really change it. And that may explain why, you know, I don't know, your sister is a really happy person and you struggle to get through it a day sometimes. So there was about 50% that they discovered was genetic. And then there's 10%, which really surprised me when I saw this, that is dictated by your life circumstances. And this is how you grew up, you know, what your work is, if you're, you know, married, single, you know, what your life circumstances are. And that only accounts for about 10% of our happiness levels, they have found. I thought that was very interesting. The good news is that 40% of the chart, pie chart, if you're thinking of a pie chart, is left. And 40% they have determined can be created through intentional activity. There's 40% that we can affect directly through what we do, how we think, and what sort of practices we do in our daily life. You know, you had talked about a mindfulness practice. I mean, that's an example of, you know, one of the tools. It's something that you hear about a lot, but it's actually doing it. Now, there are a lot of different tools that are covered, and I'm finished a certification on the science of happiness with the University of California at Berkeley, and that was great. And they give you all sorts of different tools, and then I work with some of my own things that I've gotten through life coaching, but I think Sean Acker did also studies on happiness, and he calls them happiness hygiene habits. And I love that because that's exactly what they are. If you do them regularly, they will bring you benefit. If you don't, then they won't, you know.
So can you elaborate? What is that really about? Like,
sure. One of the number one things that he points out, and I have found it to be true for me and my suffering from depression, is the practice of gratitude. Now, we've all heard about that, but what he did, which I think is really cool, is he did this study in American Express, and he got this group of people together, and they were to keep gratitude journals for 21 days. And they were to write down three things they were grateful for every day. So, you know, the old gratitude journal. And so they did that, and they were expecting to see some real changes in happiness levels. So at the end of 21 days, they measured these folks, and they had no change in their happiness levels whatsoever. So the experiment didn't work. And so Sean Acker and his team were puzzled by this. And so they went back and they interviewed the people that were in the study. And they said, well, what did you do? How did you write down your gratitude? And they found out that what people were doing is they were rotely writing down, you know, I'm grateful for my spouse, or I'm grateful for my house, or I'm grateful for my car. And they were doing the same thing every day. And they were just writing down, you know, by rote. So it meant nothing. And so they went, oh, okay, this is really interesting. So they changed the study around and asked the same participants to do it again. Okay. But this time, instead of writing down the three same things every day, you had to write down three different things every day. And you had to write down the why of it. That was really important to get that feeling state. And it could be very simple. The sun came in my window this morning, and I really liked that. Why? Because it made me feel really warm, and it made me feel like spring was coming, you know, whatever.
Okay.
But they had to write jot down a why as to why they were grateful. And so they did this for 21 days. And they found that at the end of 21 days, and this will really fascinate you, you may already have heard of it, but low-level pessimists actually changed into low-level optimists.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and that is so hard to get a pessimist to become, you know, any kind of an optimist. And they were amazed by the results, and you know, the people liked it so much they actually continued it. And Columbia University actually did the study for a longer period of time with a group of folks, and they found that their levels went up even higher the longer they kept it going. So, you know, he was talking about, and I'm a firm believer in, gratitude is one of the core tools that we have to work with. When it comes to feeling better about our lives, you know, we may not have, you know, we keep thinking that when we have the car, the money, the job, then we will be happy, you know, And it's being happy where you are first. Mm-hmm. And being grateful for those. They may be small at first, but that's okay. You know, it's finding that state.
Now, for this exercise, I forgot. Would you have to do it in the morning, or do you need three throughout the day?
You need three throughout the day. Okay. And he did another study, which I'll talk about in a minute. But in general, I believe these folks were, I instruct my folks to tend to do their happiness journals, their gratitude journals, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, because then they're scanning for gratitude throughout the day. And at the end, they can write it down.
That's, you know? I like that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a great way to end your day. And, you know, I notice a difference in my own life. I mean, I have to practice these things. Mm-hmm. So I know when I don't, I start to get crankier, grumpier, and I start to get more negative about, yep. things. I start to find myself saying those negative self-talk phrases. And I'm like, no, yep. you know, so, yeah. So that's an example of one tool. It's a real powerful one. Another tool that he found, well, here's one that we all know. And he found that this to be true, and also a Harvard science publication published a whole study on this, but the benefits of low intensity exercise. And that's out there in the news. Many people know that one, but it's, yeah. so simple. And as I'm sure that you know, it can, not in all cases, but it could be like an antidepressant for folks.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned it. One of my didactic teachers in grad school told me about a study like that, where for people like trying to get into better shape and fitness, they thought of like a low intensity workout or exercise. So it was something as simple as like raking the leaves, let's say.
Uh-huh. Right? Yeah.
So if they had a mindset of raking leaves was going to get them in better shape, so they do it with a good level of intensity, even though, again, it's not that hard to rake leaves, like physically.
Uh-huh. Right.
With the mindset of I'm going to get in really good shape, and then you're going at a decent pace. I guess in this one research, it showed that they actually started losing weight and started toning up.
Uh-huh.
Just because of their doing like raking the leaves with the positive mindset.
Yeah. Isn't that, it's amazing. It's amazing, mm-hmm. what it can do. Yeah. And the exercise increases our neurotrophic brain growth, cell growth, and the cell growth actually improves brain function. And so that actually will tend to make us happier. And it doesn't have to be this, you know, hardcore, you know, really intensive workout. It can be low level, you know, for a moderate duration, you know.
Well, and it's also like I've been trained in like thinking mindsets where, going back to the pessimistic people, they, uh-huh. consider it kind of like a ski slope, and you're skiing and you keep making this long trail going down, except it gets hardened and the ice makes it really cold. So yes. it's this really hard trail going down. That's like a mindset. That's a thought process.
Oh, that's so a great analogy. That,
you need to start going down a different path, and it's not going to work right away because the ice is so strong. But after a while, it'll start to break down and you'll, yes. go on a different path.
Oh, I love that. That's a great analogy. Yeah. Thank you very much. May I use that?
Please.
That's wonderful. I'll give you credit. No, that's a great analogy. It's true. Uh-huh. In the beginning, you don't see the change because you're on that icy, hard, yeah. path. Yeah.
Because,
well,
you've been doing it for so many years.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, that's why these things have to be repeated. It's not, mm-hmm. like one and done. And you know, when I think about the science of happiness and all of that, it's definitely not a place that you get to happiness with these tools and that's it. You're there. I'm here. I'm happy.
But God, we love the quick fix in our society. We love,
yes.
Taking the pill and it working right away forever. And yeah.
That it's so true. And yeah. it's definitely a journey, and you're going to go through hard times, and you know, it's just how you keep your mindset through the low times that we inevitably go through, mm-hmm. and then the better times, you know. And you know, being happy is an inside job, that's for sure.
I'm wondering, have you like ever worked with clients again struggling with depression due to, I guess, where they feel they are in life, like an existential crisis? Where, yeah, like, oh God, I wish I was farther in life and I don't make enough money and et cetera.
Yeah, I tend to work with a lot of people, not all the time, but the majority are, you know, I'd say around, I'm trying to think, 40, and in that 40 to 60 range, although I do have some people in their 70s. And I discovered that a lot of these people are just what you said. They're going through a life crisis. Maybe they hate their jobs. And, you know, when you talked about, do you do goal setting and stuff like that, that's when we have to use the science of happiness tools. But one of the science of happiness tools is setting, you know, intrinsically good goals and helping, you know, take those steps towards achieving those goals.
And smart goals.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Making them smart, specific, attainable, all of that, realistic, time bound. Yeah. And so sometimes it becomes very goal focused in that they have to make some changes to feel better about themselves. And that's part of the process too. Oh, yeah.
What I sometimes find difficulty in doing is not, again, telling them no, they can't do it or shattering their dreams, but to realize, okay, that's a big goal. What are a bunch of little goals we can do now to help get to that big goal? So again, I'm not telling you no, you can't do it.
Yes.
You understand kind of where you're at right now and how we can get there.
That's so true. I yes, exactly. You do have to, I constantly have to break things down into, you know, bite size. I mean, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, you know? So yeah, exactly.
It's like, or I want to be a lawyer or a doctor. I'm like, well, okay, let's get you enrolled in community college first.
Yeah.
And we'll go from there.
Yeah, let's start at the basics. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's true. And I, you know, it's interesting that you say that also, because I find that when people are getting older in their lives, their goals change. And sometimes they still want to be, you know, the CEO or the whatever of the corporation. But very often their goals are more enrichment focused goals, or finding a passion beyond their career, you know, or looking at what life will be like when they, you know, get towards the end of their career. What do they want their life to start to be? And, you know, I find that my work has taken me there a lot. And so it's something that I'm constantly trying to learn more about, read about, you know, check in with what I've done and my path and, you know, what others are doing, because it's a real, you know, we've got, you know, the baby boomers are all, you know, coming to the age of retirement, if not already retired. So and then we've got the millennials behind them. So, yeah.
Or do you ever do like a solution focused approach regarding like a miracle question, where like you wake up, let's say, in this perfect day, and what would your day even look like if you kind of had the perfect life? So it's kind of like taking away your negative symptoms. Like, okay, if you didn't have problems A, B, and C, what would your life look like when you wake up?
Oh, I love that. Yes,
do you know indeed. what it's actually about?
Yeah, exactly. I call it visualization with my clients, and I have them visualize when they're ready and they've got a goal, something like that, to visualize the perfect day, just like you said. Yeah. And to actually get into the feeling state of what it would be like to be in that day. So it's not just, you know, okay, this is in my head, but it's actually like, you know, getting excited about it. What would that feel like? Yeah. That's very powerful. And I love what you said about it takes away the negative, you know, stuff that's around that and puts us into the positive frame reframing. You know,
and again, working with my clients, like, that question is a lot harder than you think when it comes to applying to other people. Because when I will ask that question to some groups, they're like, well, I'll be an NBA player when I wake up, and I'll dunk a basketball at 10 feet. And I'm like, oh, well, that'd be nice. That's not what this is really about, even though, okay, you'd have a, you'd think you'd be happier if you do that, but you know, yeah. it kind of gets into that SMART goal thing where, okay, like if I have an anger management issue, what would it be like if I wake up and I didn't get into fights with my wife or my kids or my coworkers, yeah. and I wasn't always fighting with them? Wow, I think I would have a lot more energy, I guess. I wouldn't be so tired all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know.
So, yeah, that is so true. I think that you're right on, and that you have to constantly bring goals down to the level of where the person's at. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, if I didn't have fights with my wife all the time, you know, what would that be like? What would a day like that be, as opposed to me, you know, dunking the NBA basketball, you know, being the champion, you know, which is a fun fantasy, but that's what mm-hmm. it is. It's
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, definitely. There's a lot of talk around of visualization and what it really means. And it doesn't mean that you're just flying off to the moon. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about in the studies of the science of happiness, they talk about your best possible self activity. Yep. And that's where you write about what your life would look like if your best possible self came through on what you wanted. Wow. And what you needed and what you loved and were passionate about, what would your life look like? Mm. And they found that really raised happiness levels when people did it. Now, it's getting people to do that. Some people love to write, some people don't, you know, so it's not for everyone. But that's very similar to what you were talking about and what I was saying about visualization, except it's, you know, written down in a form in your journal every day, mm-hmm. you know. So.
Absolutely. I also, do you think, like, especially in our society too, again, when we think about like happiness, it's our values and we want more money. And I think money and salary clouds a lot of, I guess, judgment, especially mm-hmm. on who you are as a person. And, but again, are we happier with more money?
Okay. Question. Good question. And they have determined that no, not really. Now
there's a number. I think there's a number for salary. Yeah. And I don't know, again, I don't know if that's where you're getting at.
Well, yeah, I think it's around 60,000 or whatever. I think that was a salary
like
range. Maybe, could very possibly be that. You know, if you don't have money and you're struggling to put food on the table, then money, of course, is very important. You know, it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's one yes. of the basic needs there, you know. But they found that actually at beyond a certain amount of money, and I think it was, like you said, 60,000, 80,000, mm-hmm. something like that. And then for a higher bracket, even I think it was 120,000, that beyond that, we didn't get any happier. We got happier at first, but very shortly, because of something called hedonic adaptation, which means we get used to what we have and we return back to our prior happiness levels. Mm-hmm. So money doesn't make us happier. It doesn't last. It'll be an initial thrill. That's why people who win the lottery so often, their lives go to ruin because they didn't really change anything. The mm-hmm. money only makes you happy temporarily. And they found that people that were rich, really rich, had more stress and problems and really rated lower on happiness scales than people who were just, you know, normal,
right?
In a normal range, yeah. Because and they felt like they had more problems and stress than it was worth when they had tons of money.
Yeah.
So it's interesting about that.
Well, and like another example that I heard too, they try to explain like usually people who make 80 or more, they're working too much to even be able to enjoy the money that they make.
Yes. Yes. Excellent point. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's right, because it's true. You become a slave to your job, you know, and that's a path to unhappiness right there. Yeah. I mean, the job may give you a kick, but I've been a slave to my job before and I enjoyed mm-hmm. the job, but I lost so much else in my life, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
You know, it's like another sad factor too. Like I'm a total geek when it comes to like YouTube videos and well, God, I'll tell you one thing right now. Ever since COVID, I've been hooked on YouTube. I don't know why, but I've just been hooked. I even got the premium version because I was tired of the commercials.
Yeah, no, I hear you. YouTube is fantastic.
Oh, yes. God, yeah. And I've been like listening to a lot of like relationship podcasts too and dating. And it's scary for me because like I believe in a lot of what this guy says. That's scary because like I think a lot of the advice he gives is true, but he talks about like dating and relationships and money, and he's gets to points where it's just like women will find you more attractive if you have more money type thing. And the sad thing is like he's right to an extent. It's just like there's a lot, and I'm sure it goes with men too. You know, we strive to make more money because again, we think we get the status and that more people like women will like us.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And you know, that's a tough one because when you want to be attractive and desired out there, so you know, money talks big. And you know, there's the old saying, I'm sure you've heard it, it's just as easy to fall in love with a rich man as it is with a poor man.
Yep.
You know, and I did not fall in love with a rich man, so I didn't, but I know a lot of people, you know,
well, it's not genuine. It's not genuine. If you know that person's with you for the money, or if it's like so obvious where it's like you each kind of get something from each other again, but again, it's not going to last. It's no way to set a base for any relationship.
You're right. It's really rickety. I mean, it's not a strong foundation whatsoever because you're not talking about the love and the friendship element. And that's what sustains it over the long period, you know, is that sense of, well, friendship becomes very important as you get older, but the love's got to be there, that true love, you know, and that goes beyond even passion.
You know, it's funny. I had an old friend tell me this a long time ago about like the importance of marriage and like marrying someone, not just solely on their looks, but like having like characteristics they like or something you talk about. It's a little inappropriate, but like he said, you know, once you're in your 80s and 90s and you're sitting across from your wife, and again, you don't have those types of urges anymore, whatever, you're going to need something to talk about. And again, it's kind of a funny, inappropriate joke, but I understand what he was saying.
Yeah, I do too. It's true. You are going to need something to talk about. Yeah. I think as people get older, I mean, you know, granted, you can have passion throughout your relationship, no doubt. But the friendship value is what, you know, the compatibility, the sharing of common values to a great extent. If your values are very different, you know, I don't care how much money you have, that's not going to help a lot.
Yeah. Or it's not going to change the fact that you're friend zoned or, you know, all those things. And again, I know I'm getting off topic, but it's
No, that's great. No, I love it. That's so interesting. No, it's true. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a lot more than everything's a lot more than money. It seems like, even though that's in our country, we put money really big, don't we? You know,
yeah. Again, it's that power status, you know, people look up to you.
Yeah, it's true. Even the country, it's run by money. So, you know, it talks still.
Well, and the sad thing is, if you do like another visual like exercise, if you have like person A, person B, and you don't know anything about them, but you say person A makes 35 grand a year and person B makes 150, what natural assumptions do you make towards each of those people? Oh, that person's obviously a hard worker, smarter. This one's lazy or has issue. You know, like that's just some of the popular answers you'd get from.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's really, this is going off topic now. So sorry.
Please,
sorry about
please.
That. No. But there's some show, I have not watched it, but it's about, maybe you've heard of it. It's about women get to choose a guy, and they're both like good looking or whatever, and it's, they're on an island or something like that.
Okay.
And one of them's dirt poor and the other one's rich, and everybody wants to try and choose the rich.
But they
one.
Don't know, right? Is it a mystery?
Yeah, they don't know. It's a mystery. Yeah.
Okay, I've heard of it.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't watched it, but I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah.
I thought you were going to get into, have you ever heard of Love is Blind?
Yes. Tell me more about it, because I don't know that much about it.
So there's this guy called, Psychology in Seattle. He runs he's a licensed marriage and family therapist. But he reacts in the show, again, I'm a little off topic again, but the show is actually based on, okay, these two people meet each other, but there's a wall, so they don't right away get to see what each other looks like. But they're talking, they're having conversations.
Yeah.
Right, to get to know each other.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And they have to make a decision, okay, am I going to get engaged to this person? Just by talking, but again, not seeing what they look like. And they make the decision, and then like episode 2 or 3, they meet each other in person. And then that's where it gets kind of interesting.
Oh, I've got to watch that, because I think
Love is Blind. I think
Love is Blind. I happened onto an episode and I didn't know it was called Love is Blind, but there was a wall between them and they were talking. And that was what the show was about. They hadn't met yet, but
So I think you would like this, but again, this guy, just type in Psychology in Seattle. I really respect him. He does YouTube reaction videos to shows like this from a therapist point of view.
Oh, great.
So it's very intriguing, but then he also admits too, it's like, well, in a therapy sense, this is what this is, but again, it's a show. They could be acting. So I don't know if this is true or not, but this is just what I'm thinking, going off their reactions.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Psychology in Seattle.
Okay, I wrote it down. That's great.
Okay, Love is Blind.
Love is Blind.
Oh, but my God, back in the early 2000s or whatever, you know, MTV, there was this show and I thought it was funny at the time, but again, I'm just thinking about so much psychological damage it could have done to these people.
Uh-huh.
Just like Love is Blind too, of course, because the whole world's watching.
Yeah,
but it was called Next. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
But yeah,
you have.
Yeah, and I don't remember. Tell me.
So it's obviously there's men and women, but like one show there'll be like 5 guys in a bus with one beautiful woman.
Yes. Oh, I know that show. Oh,
it's so horrible to the psyche. Where, let's say, a dude would walk out of the bus and the woman would look at him, Next. Right away, and then he'll turn around, or he'll make like a snarky comment back to the woman and then go back on the bus. So another guy would come in and, you know, it'd go from there.
Yes. Oh, I've watched that. As a therapist, you must be like cringing when you see
that.
Now
I'm cringing.
That's, yeah.
Maybe back when I was like a teenager, I'm like, ooh, I would think like, ooh, that sucks or whatever. But now I'm thinking like, oh my God, it's so
damaging.
So mentally, you're right, mentally damaging.
Oh God, I remember that show. It was cruel. It was downright, and the crueler it was, the better the ratings were. You know what I mean?
Yep.
They went for cruelness.
You know, and it's funny, I also watched this one video. I think it was an interview with Joe Rogan, Dr. Carl Hart. I don't know if you ever heard of him or not.
Yes, I have, but I don't know him.
But he's really good. He's he has his PhD in psychopharmacology.
Oh, wow.
So he has a lot of really cool, interesting things to say about like drug addiction, therapy, life. It's really good. But I remember he was talking about that Dr. Drew guy. He does a lot of MTV shows. He does a lot of like recovery shows too.
Yeah, he does.
And he was just saying like what a negative person he is and how arrogant he is. But the main point he's trying to make is like, as healthcare professionals, you have to know that when you're like these people, like on the show Intervention, are trying to get help, or now I even think there's like couple therapy reality show. So this actual therapist is doing couples therapy with like these celebrities. And the point he's trying to make again, he's like, that helps nobody. Just the fact that you're attempting to do therapy with the whole world watching you. You know you're doing harm to those people and that client and that couple or that family member.
It's again, you know, I've always been bothered by that. I always was like, it just doesn't
too.
seem right to me on a very fundamental level. You know, talk about blurring boundaries. I mean, that's just like doing that kind of thing in public view. That's where it gets to be too much, because I mean, you're sharing, hopefully you're sharing private stuff. And, you know, it's you're not sharing your secrets with the whole world, you know?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And I'm sure they have signed some policy agreement or HIPAA thing. It's just, again, what he's saying is, like, if you're a therapist or a doctor doing that, you know what you're doing. You know you're causing harm, but you're doing it anyways. And again, I'm sure they're getting paid very well.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure Drew Pinsky did. Was he saying that about Drew Pinsky?
Yeah, he's like the tall guy with the white
hair. Oh, yeah. I know him. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep. Yep. Dr. Drew. Yeah. Oh, he was on. There was a show about
16 and Pregnant. Was it 16 and Pregnant?
Well, there's that, too. But this show was about a recovery group.
Yep.
And he would. Yeah. And he would come in and be the therapist for the recovery group. And it was all done on TV. And I was like, wow, Jesus. When I went through recovery, I wouldn't have wanted that, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because Dr. Carl Hart knew some of those people on the show. Uh-huh. And, like, I think Dennis Rodman was a cat or person on the show, too. He's like, half those people aren't even trying to get sober. They're just there to be on the show.
Yeah, they're there for their careers. Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe it. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
And even the people that aren't famous that go on these shows, they're trying to get their 15 minutes of fame, I think.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah, it's really something. I mean, talk about walking a path that won't make you healthier and happier. My goodness, you know?
Oh, yeah. Just going back to like the 16 and Pregnant, when that first show came out, now you kind of see where they're at now.
Yeah.
I mean, not all of them seem like completely unstable, but some of them are for sure.
I would imagine. That's just, again, that's another thing. That's where we get too public with too much. But, you know, America wants to see it, you know? So, yeah.
But like, it's not hard enough being 16 and pregnant.
Yeah, I know. Right. Exactly. Uh-huh. Let's show it to the world. Yeah.
But again, what do you say, though, if this company or the show comes to you and be like, hey, we'll give you so much money. And then you go on the show. Like,
yeah, I know. It's hard to turn down. That's takes a very strong parent, I would think, to guide their child in that situation.
Or an unhealthy parent, which we've seen in the show. There's a lot. I think, I don't know if you remember Farrah on the show, but like her and her mom had a really toxic relationship and they did the couples therapy show.
Uh-huh.
And oh, I'm just watching it cringing right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm. I didn't see that particular show, but I know who you're talking about. Oh, my God. Yeah.
I think she turned into like a porn star too for a little bit. And
oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Again, I just have to thank you so much.
Oh, listen.
Being on the show is awesome. It really was.
It was great talking with you. I can't tell you how much I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. I really had a good time.
I did. And I know my listeners did. And if they do want to get a hold of you, my listeners, is there like a website or an email address they could apply to get a hold of you?
Oh, sure. It's www.brighterbetterdays.com. And then my email address, my Brighter Better Days email is broken down, unfortunately, but my email address is Ant, A-N-T, and then my last name, which is Banowitz, B-A-N-E-W-I-C, and then Z as in zebra, @gmail.com. Yeah.
Tell me, and I'll make sure I put those links to my show notes too.
So oh, okay, great. That. Thank you.
Just
thank
be
you.
Safe.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it. So this was great. I wish you the best of luck in your career. It sounds like you're doing wonderfully and really helping a lot of people. So that's great.
Well, terrific. You as well, too. And again, I had a great time and I learned a lot and it was really fun.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Take good care. Stay in touch.
I just want to again thank everyone for another awesome BHI episode. Antonio was another amazing guest for BHI. I also want to inform all of my listeners that the information and content expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, seek the care of a professional medical doctor and a licensed mental health therapist. All right, thank you and have a good day. Bye.